in this edition of the Digital Music News Podcast.
So is the industry in trouble here?
I think it is. Really, what you have to say is, if they didn't put in this eight-note sequence of descending quarter notes, which is so common, some authors have said, my six-year-old played something like this the other day. No offense to Flame, but this isn't that hard.
It wasn't. It's three notes or four notes or something.
It's Flame's song was, and this is in the background of verse of Katy Perry's song. It was CBA. So it's CCCCBBBA. And in Katy Perry's, it was CCCCBBAE. So are those similar? Yes, it sounds similar, but so what?
The music industry has always had copyright infringement lawsuits. There's always been a debate about this stuff, seemingly going back forever. But are we entering a brand new period, a dark period of music copyright trolling? Are bands just coming out of nowhere and saying, I wrote this simple melody 5 years before you did, and now you have to hand me $3 million? Sounds scary, and it's actually happening in reality. So just recently, Katy Perry and her collaborators on Dark Horse were hit with a $2.78 million fine for copying the work of Christian rapper Flame, whose Joyful Noise does have a very similar melodic intro. There are also a lot of differences. However, a jury decided unanimously that this was plagiarism. Here's a listen to both tracks.
You know what it is?
Here you were. You were gonna come to me.
And here you are.
But you better choose carefully.
Cause I'm
capable of anything. Of anything. And everything.
Here you were.
You were gonna come to me.
And here you are.
But you better choose carefully.
Cause
capable of anything, of anything, and everything.
So as you can hear, lots of similarities, but lots of differences, to the point that a lot of people have said, wait, this is getting out of control. This melody is not that complicated. This rhythm is not that complicated. Two separate parties could have come up with the same thing. Two separate parties could have written Mary Had a Little Lamb separately. It's not that complicated. So this wouldn't be so scary if we didn't have other cases that just happened or are ongoing. One notable case is Led Zeppelin's battling against an infringement claim over Stairway to Heaven. Even the U.S. government has weighed in on this case. So the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Copyright Office saying, wait, this isn't a real copyright case. This isn't what copyright should be about. Led Zeppelin is getting trolled here. And then there's a famous Blurred Lines case in which Pharrell and Robin Thicke were saddled with also a multi-million dollar fine, not for copying the notes and rhythms of Marvin Gaye, but merely for copying a style, an instrumentation, a feel that Marvin Gaye has perfected, you know, and made famous. So, wow, it does feel like we're entering into newfound territory. So my guest this week is top music industry attorney Ed McPherson, is also saying enough and has become one of the activist attorneys trying to fight back and sort of put a little bit more normalcy back into this copyright litigation process, and trying to tamp down the trolling a bit. Exactly how he's going to accomplish that, we get into in the podcast. And I asked him very specifically, do we have a problem? He said yes. Here are the specifics of that. My guest this week, Ed McPherson of McPherson LLP. All right, Ed McPherson, thank you so much for coming to the Digital Music News Podcast. For those who don't know, Ed is one of the premier music industry attorneys, but you also, over your 35 plus year career, have ventured out beyond into entertainment, sports, NFL. Even read that you cut your teeth on complex insurance litigation. So you've really done it all. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, Paul.
Thank you. And by the way, I've got to ask you, so you are a California super lawyer. What is that?
It seems like everybody is a California super lawyer.
Oh, really?
Okay. They say it's the top 5% of lawyers, but
really?
Pretty much everyone I know is in there. So it is what it is.
I see.
Lawyers is a great thing, and they have profiles. They have all kinds of things. So I think it's great, but and maybe it's just a coincidence that most of my friends are in there. But yeah.
So. Okay, well, good. You're modest about it. This is great. Wow. So I'm going to pack in as much as we can. I know your time is intense. So let me start with the Katy Perry trial. Okay. So this has been enormously controversial within the music industry. There are things that people don't want to say out loud about this, the results. Basically, for anyone just tuning in on this, Katy Perry, along with Capitol Records, along with Max Martin, along with Dr. Luke, Cobalt, the list goes on, were just saddled with a $2.78 million penalty for copyright infringement of allegedly infringing the track by Flame called Joyful Noise. Anyone who's heard the comparison side by side knows that the intro, yeah, kind of sounds the same, but anyone who knows music knows it's kind of three or four notes that are somewhat similar. Before I ask you any questions, I want to read a little bit that you've written on this matter in a scathing critique of this.
All I can do is scathing with respect to this case, let me tell
that's,
you.
That's great. That's good. That's good content. Let's see. So you write, Katy Perry verdict. The carnage continues. This is on your blog, the McPherson LLP blog, which is McPherson-LLP.com for those interested in reading more. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said that it was just one case. They said that it would not affect other cases. Many said that it was an outlier. Well, they were wrong. The Blurred Lines case, which we'll also talk about, is alive and well in its latest form. The case with the unfortunate moniker, the Katy Perry case, even though there were 9 other defendants in the case, the opening floodgates that I previously foretold, check. The stifling of musical artists' creativity, check. With exclamation points.
Of course.
Copyright juries gone wild, check. We have it all, and there is no sign that it is going to let up anytime soon. So is the industry in trouble here?
I think it is. I really see this as an outgrowth of the Blurred Lines case. There was one case in between, which was the Led Zeppelin case, which I was tangentially involved in by writing an amicus brief as well. That in that case, the jury actually got it right, and then the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed it.
Right, and it's still going on now.
It's still going on, yeah. There's a hearing on the week of September 23rd up in San Francisco before the what's called en banc review, which is 11 judges of the Ninth Circuit are going to review the entire case. So really 3 cases in a row, one that got it right but maybe turned around, and 2 others that got it just horrendously wrong.
Let me ask you, so we actually had Richard Bush on the podcast.
Yep.
Right after.
He disagrees with me.
Oh, he does. But I was trying to ask him those tough questions, and I asked him, I said, hey, is this the beginning of a flood of different copyright lawsuits of this kind? And he said, no, it's so difficult to get these cases going, and it's not going to be a floodgates. And here we have the Katy Perry trial a few months later.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because someone just printed, might have been you, that just printed 30 songs or tracks that were just designated diamond. And I'm not sure how many streams
like
that is or anything like that, right? But 30, and if you look at them, many of them have been very public lawsuits. for copyright infringement. Yeah. So you put out a list like that, and I feel like there's some plaintiff's lawyer sitting at home, or some potential plaintiff sitting at home saying, all right, let me see. Katy Perry, check. All right, let me see. Who do we have next? It just is. If you have a big artist, and especially if it's a big song, these days there's going to be a suit. You know, there was always a little bit of that, but I think it's getting much worse.
The famous, where there's a hit, there's a writ.
Absolutely.
But now it's getting way worse, is what you're saying.
I think so. Because unfortunately, the courts are not stopping these cases in time. They're letting them go to the juries. It's not like film and television cases. And that's been my big thing. And I've written amicus briefs in the Blurred Lines case and in the Led Zeppelin case. And I anticipate a new one coming soon to the Court of Appeals, basically saying, look, you got to change things. You have to instruct your district court judges to be a little more strict on what they let go to the jury. And what I mean by that is, in a film and television case, you have things called scènes à faire, which are common things. So you have a chase scene in an action movie.
There you go. Okay.
Things like that. Okay. Everyone knows that that's a common thing. So if I say, hey, I wrote this movie and it has a chase scene in it, the judge is going to say, everyone's going to say, well, that's ridiculous. There's a chase scene in every movie.
Right.
So,
but they don't understand music theory.
That's
at
exactly
all.
Right. And so the judge looks at that and says, I'm throwing this case out. I'm not letting it get to a jury because there's not enough there. And in a music case, the judge looks at it, says, look, I don't speak this language, so let me hear from the experts.
Right.
You get one expert saying, this is a car chase or a rabbit out of the hat for a magician. You have another expert saying, no, this is the most unique piece of music I've ever seen in my life.
But why would a musicologist say that, let's just take the Katy Perry case, why would a musicologist say that these are similar at all?
You know, I hate to be skeptical, but you pay experts enough and they say what they say.
There it is.
You know, in the Blurred Lines case, the Mr. Bush's expert reportedly was paid $350,000.
Should that be legal?
It's a free market. You can do whatever you want. But I think, you know, juries are supposed to be told that. I don't know if they were in that case, but you got to take it with a grain of salt. If someone has to be paid that much money to say what they're saying, you know, is it really that? Is it that uncommon a thing? That uncommon a musical phrase? You have to go into that, and I think unfortunately, you have juries that don't know anything about music. I'll tell you a quick thing on Blurred Lines, and then we get back to Katy Perry. Howard King, who's a friend of mine, who tried the Blurred Lines case for Pharrell and for Robin Thicke, the jury comes back after 2.5 days. And they give the verdict for the gays. And Howard says, well, jury, or a couple members of the jury, you've been out for 2.5 days. You never listen to the music. What's up with that? And the jury said, as I understand it from Howard, music's music. We don't know from music. The judge said, listen to the experts. We did. The other side had 2 experts. You had 1. What's up with that?
Okay. So, and it wasn't played in the courtroom?
What's that?
The music itself, side by side?
The music itself, well, that gets into a whole other thing, because what music was played and all that. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
But if you're going to be out for 2.5 days and deliberating and trying to figure things out, wouldn't you think they'd listen at least once to it?
Many, many times.
But they're just going through the 350,000 paid expert testimony versus the other testimony and saying, all right, which do we believe here?
Right.
And ultimately, they believed the costlier expert's testimony. And that's it. And look, I don't want to be too cynical. There are disagreements that all experts have over different things. And I'm not just saying that they prostitute themselves out and just will say whatever anybody says. But certainly there's an element of that in there. And you can have two people disagree. But when so many expert musicologists agree with the one side and so few agree with the other, in the Blurred Lines case, Ken Freundlich is an attorney friend of mine who filed an amicus brief on behalf of, I think, 11 musicologists saying, this is horrible. This is not something that should be the subject of copyright infringement.
The thing I keep thinking is the music industry, do they have their own copyright trolling problem? So we've heard of patent trolling, right? That's been a decades-long problem. And the industry has adapted in various ways. Courts have had their travails with patent trolling. Does the music industry now have a copyright trolling problem?
Oh, I think so. There are some people that say you're not a troll if it's a real infringement. All right, but it's a chicken and the egg thing. Which happens mm-hmm. first, the infringement or the, you know, somebody looks at something. Like I said earlier, the top 30 songs that were all designated diamond, I think there are people looking through that saying, hey, look, I wrote a song that's kind of like that. And you go to a lawyer and the lawyer says, yeah, I'll take this. Why not? Why not roll mm-hmm. the dice?
Yeah.
Because what happens yeah. in these cases is even though in theory the loser pays attorney's fees, it's not always that way, number one. And number two, most of these plaintiffs can't afford the attorney's fees. So even though I had a couple cases for Fergie where we won on copyright infringement, we won on summary judgment, and we got an attorney's fees award against the plaintiff, and they couldn't pay it. So nothing's okay. ever been paid.
Yeah.
So Fergie
yeah.
has to pay a ton of money.
It's a total
other
gamble.
Fees as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so for a plaintiff and a plaintiff's lawyer, why not roll the dice?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it can be expensive. It can be costly. But if you have someone that'll put up those costs for you, you roll the dice and you get, what, $2.78 million?
Yeah, there you go.
Or five plus in the
borderline
case? It's
basically like entering the lottery. You might win.
You know, it's interesting because I wrote an article years ago after a particular sample case that I had, and it was called Pick Me, the New Copyright Lottery, which is on my website.
I'm going to check
that
out.
Which is the second half of this, and that is aside from the liability problems in Katy Perry and other cases, you have damages problems because what the damages are supposed to be are the amount of the revenue from the sale of the allegedly infringing material, Katy Perry's mm-hmm. Dark
yeah.
Horse, the amount of the revenue that she and the other songwriters and the record label and the publisher received that were attributable to the infringement. So that they were attributable to, the amount of revenue that was attributable to Joyful Noise, or the alleged copying of Joyful Noise.
Okay.
So what I put in my article is that, look, you have many elements that make up the revenue of a song. And in this case, you have Katy Perry, one of the biggest stars in the world. She has 91 awards. She has 303 nominations, 13 Grammy nominations. You have Dr. Luke. You have all these superstars. You have Juicy J, who has an Academy Award.
Yeah, I didn't even mention him. Yeah.
Yeah, you have all of these elements into this song that went into the making of this song and into the revenue from the song. You have all these superstars. You have the other music in the song, which is a ton. This wasn't even about melody.
There's
there
really
is
one
no
hook.
Melody in
yeah.
Joyful Noise and
right.
Joyful Noise.
Yeah.
You have all this stuff and the lyrics, because there are no common lyrics in mm-hmm. these things. And so what the jury came up with was, well, looking at all those factors, we think that these eight notes that they not even copied completely, but copied the feel of, are worth 22.5% of the revenue of Dark Horse. Are you kidding me? That's absurd.
That's right. So there you go. Without that list of superstars, without Katy Perry fronting, without... Beyond that, you have so many other people who are strategizing and pushing this piece.
Sure.
Without all of that, maybe it's 1%. If
1%.
That, yeah.
If that,
yeah.
exactly. Because
yeah.
really what you have to say is, if they didn't put in this eight-note sequence of descending quarter notes, which is so common, mm-hmm. some authors have said, my six-year-old played something like this the other day. No offense to Flame, but this isn't that hard.
It wasn't. It's three notes or four notes or something.
Yeah. It's Flame's song was, and this is in the background of verse of Katy Perry's song, it was CBA. So it's CCCCBBBA. And in Katy Perry's, it was CCCCBBAE. So are those similar? Yes, it sounds similar, but so what?
Mm-hmm.
That just doesn't matter. That is such a basic building block that I think you can't possibly say that that's enough to have copyright protection
mm-hmm.
so that if you use something similar, it's an infringement. It
so
just
let me ask you, in that light, many, many years ago, there was the lawsuit between Tom Petty, R.I.P., and Sam Smith, the Stay With Me copyright case. Are you familiar with
yes,
that?
Yes, a little bit.
That hook also seemed to have just, you know, it was like three notes with the exact same cadence and rhythm. And Stay With Me was, you know, these three notes were the center of it, just as Tom Petty's track.
Yeah.
That was also similarly controversial. Boiling it down, is there a way that the industry could come up with some rule that could say And this is, I'm asking your legal expertise if there is a way that some principles or guidelines could be created to say, beyond this point, we're looking at infringement. For example, direct use of a recording or 16 notes in a row. I'm making this up, but is there some way a standard can be created?
You know, it's hard because different notes, musicologists will tell you different notes have different values, meaning that you can have the same three notes in the back of a song, but put that in the melody and it's different, and it might be part of the hook. And there's so many elements. So I think it would be very hard to do that. At least in the Petty song, it was the hook of the song. It was the part of the melody.
Really,
it wasn't
in the center
deep
of it,
in the background,
right,
where it's just beep, 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 beep.
Right.
That's crazy. That's deep in the middle of a verse of the Katy Perry song with a million other elements going on. So at least you have that. But as far as having some objective way, I don't think there's any real way to do that. Although, you know, there's a new suit apparently against Lady Gaga where now it's down to three notes.
It
I
is.
Think it's G-A-B or something like that. So it really is a continuum here, starting from, who knows, Blurred Lines, maybe before then, going worse and worse and worse. But I don't think there's any way to have an objective way to do that. A lot of musicians used to come to me and say, well, I understand if I change this music 30%, then it's not an infringement. And I say, well, actually, if you start with their music and you change it at all, it is an infringement because you started with their music. So that's not wrong. So that's a common misconception that people have of an objective way to not be an infringement. So you can't really have that. But I think that judges have to be more proactive in trying to get to the bottom of things. Other people have suggested that instead of giving it to juries that really know nothing about music, that somehow we come up with a panel of experts. And then I've been asked, well, what about patent cases? What about other cases where there's hard scientific stuff and juries seem to get it? And what I say is, look, I'm not involved in those cases. I'm a musician myself, so I'm passionate about this stuff. I believe in copyright protection, but I also believe that every person that gets a hit shouldn't have somebody suing them saying, I wrote these three notes, so I should get 8 notes, so I should get 22.5% of your revenue, even though I didn't do anything, even though my song with my stuff never made any money. How do you explain that? If your song's responsible for 22.5% of my revenue, or 2.78 million, how do you explain that you didn't make any money on it?
What's really sitting in terms of my future prognostications about this, you've got so much publishing catalog being scooped up now, huge acquisitions, Hypnosis, Round Hill, on down the line, a lot of catalogs being acquired with gains already happening. Do you think this threat impacts the valuation of publishing catalogs, or could impact the valuation of publishing catalogs and recording catalogs for that matter in the future?
You know, I guess it could. I don't see that as a huge thing. You know, the potential is always there to get sued on things. I don't see it as far as a company that's buying up a huge catalog, really paying a lot of time, putting a lot of time in or a lot of attention to that kind of thing. Because the catalog as a whole is going to have the same value.
Okay. Next question. Is there an opportunity here for some sort of litigation insurance or copyright trolling insurance? Have you heard anything on that front? And I haven't. I'm asking if it's come up.
Sure. There is errors and omissions insurance that songwriters and artists can get.
Okay.
It's very expensive. And, you know, unfortunately, I hate to say this, being an attorney, but the attorney's fees in these cases oftentimes are horrendous because they have to be. And unfortunately, a lot of cases in the past have been settled because the fees are getting so much, you have to just stop the bleeding and that's it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that has encouraged more plaintiffs to come out because they know I can have a song that doesn't sound anything like yours. But if I sue you hard enough and make you pay enough to your lawyers, at some point you're going to yell uncle and say, all right, I can't take it anymore. I'll throw you some money just because I can pay you $150 or pay my lawyer $500,000. That's an easy economic decision and that's it.
You'd be amazed because I got an email the other day from someone who claimed to have given Lil Nas X
oh, geez.
His idea for hooking up with the chorus, for creating the chorus on a song and connecting with Billy Ray Cyrus on Old Town Road. And it was this lengthy thing, and he claims that he was the Uber driver for Lil Nas X. And I'm thinking, wow, this stuff... Yeah. This stuff is endless.
This is the kind, you know, thankfully copyright does not protect ideas. But yeah, that doesn't surprise me. It doesn't, everybody's given everybody, you know, back in the day, I used to have people come in and sue my clients and say, you know, we're at a party and don't you remember I handed you a cassette tape and off in the corner somewhere. And I had one with a band Poison back in the day. Who I'm very close to, a great bunch of guys.
Great band.
They met them down at NAMM, and they brought a couple of them back to a party. I think Brett Michaels and maybe Ricky Rocket, I don't remember. But they went to this party, and the entire party is on film. Somebody was filming, and this was before the day of iPhones and everything else, so this was pretty elaborate. And they have Brett playing a song and everything else. The only thing they don't have on there was when the guy said, gee, I have a song I'd like you to hear. And supposedly Brett went out with him, and the guy brought back in a briefcase this cassette and played it for Brett. And Brett said, that's the most incredible song I've ever heard. And then a song came out, you know, a year later, and they sued Poison over the song. The only problem was Richie Kotzen, who was in the band temporarily, wrote their song and wasn't even at this party. So you have,
and this
stuff
alleged
like that.
Altercation was not documented at all.
The only thing in the world that wasn't on tape that night was
this thing, somehow or other.
Yeah, right. It's just crazy.
That is crazy. Okay, so let me ask you, in terms of how the songwriting process happens now, do you find that artists and songwriters are fearful or doing extra checks? I have talk to a company that is introducing a service, and I'm sure they'll announce it in the coming weeks, where you can at least go back and check to see if your work bears similarity to other works, some sort of way to at least protect yourself. What's the vibe amongst your clients, songwriters that you've talked to? Is there fear and trepidation? What's going on out there?
I think there's fear and trepidation. I really do. In my amicus briefs in the Blurred Lines case and the Led Zeppelin case, I said cases like this are going to stifle creativity, particularly in the Blurred Lines case when they were tagged, Robin Thicke and Pharrell were tagged basically for mimicking a feel or a vibe. Mm-hmm. There were no notes, there were no chords that were the same, there really wasn't much that were same, but there was clapping, there were voices, there were all these things that went
heavily
into this.
Inspired by,
and heavily inspired, and they admitted that they were inspired by Marvin Gaye, who wasn't, and that became a problem for them, and they got tagged for that, so you have this feel. And so what I put in my brief was, look, one could argue that every disco song has the same feel. Every rap song has the same feel. So if you can't copy that feel, do we have one rap song, one disco song? That just makes no sense.
Right, it would make no sense. Right. Everything feeds off everything else.
So you've got artists now, after Blurred Lines, saying, well, gee, you know, I really like, you know, pick an artist. Dr. Dre, but you know, if I do this thing that has the same feel as a Dre song, I could get tagged for this. I don't have the kind of money Pharrell has. I can't withstand that. I can't pay lawyers for this. So maybe I shouldn't write this song. And what I put in my brief is, if that one artist, that one songwriter says I shouldn't write this song, that's a tragedy. Even if it's just one song, and there are many more I am certain of, that people are not writing because they say, look, I don't want to have something that's the same feel. I certainly don't ever want to give anybody credit, right? And how bad is that? And what I put in my brief in Blurred Lines was that's bad for Marvin Gaye. When somebody writes a song and they say, look, this is an homage to Marvin Gaye, and now they can't say that. Now they write a song and they say, who are your influences? And you have to say, you know, generally everybody, I like music. You're not going to say Marvin Gaye. What does that do to Marvin Gaye and his memory and everything else? People want that. People want, there are building blocks of music that you use. Everybody uses a little bit of somebody else's stuff. That's not infringement. That's just building blocks getting to the next point. There are only 12 notes on a scale that you can use. And again, it's not like film and television. You can write about past, present, future, fiction, nonfiction, anything you want. You can write about this room. But in music, you have 12 notes to work with. There are millions and millions of songs out there. Something's going to sound the same. That doesn't mean it's an infringement.
I want to ask you about the Led Zeppelin case.
Yeah.
Because I got really into this in the thick of it. And it turned out that, you know, the famous opening guitar line was actually pretty much note for note played or written in the 15th century, I believe. It was shocking. There is actually a YouTube video of it that I found.
I actually never saw that. That's
yeah, I'm going to forward this to you. It was shocking. And it was an Italian guitarist.
Interesting.
Baroque, maybe pre-Baroque. I can't quite remember. But yeah, the lick was pretty much note for note.
See, that's what the musicologist's job is. In the Led Zeppelin case, the musicologist was Dr. Lawrence Ferrara from NYU, who coincidentally was the same musicologist in the Katy Perry case for Katy Perry. One of the things he's amazing at is coming up with what's called prior art, which means you didn't write it, here it is. You know, you, the plaintiff, didn't write this. This goes back to, you know, as you say, way, way, way back when. There was one author, and might have been Dr. Farrar as well, that in the Katy Perry case said, you know, this kind of thing, this ostinato, they called it, dates back to Bach. So there are going to be things that are back there that are in the public domain. And if you, you know, if you as a plaintiff write a song that takes from this public domain, takes from that thing, that piece of music that you're talking about, and then I do the same thing, how am I infringing you?
Right? Yeah, and actually, this next fun fact I will bring up, and this is all little like things I haven't investigated enough yet, but apparently there was a company in Germany whose name I never learned. It was only in hearsay in a conversation. Apparently this company would go back and find any melody in modern pop music, and they claimed they could find virtually any melody
in some public domain thing way back when. Sure.
Exactly.
Again, and it's only 12 notes. It doesn't surprise me.
But let me ask you, as an incredibly experienced litigator and in these matters, I've had it then explained to me that doesn't quite matter. That if Led Zeppelin pulled a track from Spirit, it doesn't matter if there's a exact replica of that melody from the 15th century.
Look, what's supposed to matter in copyright law is that you actually copied somebody else, but their music has to be copyrightable as well. So what I'm saying is, in these cases, if they could prove that you really heard this 15th century thing or something like that and you copied that, that's in the public domain, you can copy that. If you can prove that and that you never heard the Spirit song, then you should win. Led Zeppelin, in their case, claimed that they had never heard the Spirit song, and the jury found otherwise. They found that they did have what's called access to the song. But they said, notwithstanding that, it's not a copy. And that's it. In copyright law, basically, you're supposed to prove that you couldn't have independently come up with this on your own.
Yeah.
So that's why, to prove this copying, you prove a combination of access to the music and substantial similarity of the music. But if you could somehow prove that, you have to prove the access. You have to prove, in theory, that you heard their song. And that's another troubling thing, actually, and sorry to go off point, but another troubling thing in the Katy Perry case is that they said, look, we've never heard this guy's song before. It was never played on the radio. I think it was nominated for a Grammy, but we don't hear all of those songs. I don't think Katy Perry was even a voting member at the time that she helped write this. Dr. Luke was. But he said, I didn't hear this. There's a ton of songs that come in with that. I don't listen to them all. I think Luke testified in trial that, look, when I am writing, when I am creating, I don't listen to any music. I turn everything off so that I can do things independent and come up with things on my own. I think it was actually, who was it? Hold on one sec. It was one of the other writers. It was Circuit, I believe, that came up with this ostinato, and Circuit testified at trial exactly how he came up. I was thinking this, and here's where I was, and then Luke picked me up, and this, and this, and this. I mean, they really said what exactly they did. And when you prove what's called independent creation, that you created it on your own, in theory, even if it's exactly like it, it's not an infringement because you created it independently and coincidentally, and that's it. So you're right. Just because there's prior art doesn't mean you get off the hook. But if I'm a juror and I hear all these songs that sound more like the defendant's song than the plaintiff's song did, I'm going to say, look, they didn't copy yours. If anything, they copied these things. They're not on trial for that here. I just don't believe this was an infringement. But the juries aren't doing that, unfortunately.
Right, and it was a unanimous decision, which was even more shocking. So what's next? Can this be overturned? Can it be nullified? Can there be a very clear precedent in the other direction established?
I don't think there'll be a... Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it's still at the district court, meaning that the district court judge has what's called post-trial motions that she has to deal with. I talked to some lawyers from the Katy Perry case yesterday that said that that should be teed up around November. Post-trial motions are basically saying, look, the jury came to this conclusion. They really couldn't have because of X, Y, and Z. For instance, access. The jury came to the conclusion that there was access to the Flame music basically because it was out there. We have so much streaming and music is everywhere now. Mm-hmm. Which brings up another issue, and that is now in the age of streaming, in the age where you can get music on demand and anywhere you want, is there any more access requirement, or is that just a given now? They assume you had access because the music played in many places.
Yeah.
And so that's something the judge could take a look at and say, look, I shouldn't let that part get to the jury. I'm finding that as a matter of law, the plaintiff did not prove access. And so she could take away the jury verdict. Depending on what the district court judge does, if she doesn't take away the verdict, then it will go to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Ninth Circuit will take a look at it, as they did in the Led Zeppelin case. And in Led Zeppelin, the Ninth Circuit, in theory, got it wrong, the three-panel member of judges for the Ninth Circuit. And so the Led Zeppelin people appealed to get a rehearing in banc, as I said earlier, before 11 judges of the Ninth Circuit. So you can go there, and after that, it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. But they don't take many copyright cases.
Okay. So sounds like there are many, many chapters ahead on this.
Yeah.
Ed, I want to thank you for coming by and really illuminating so many of the details of this case. I hope you'll come back.
Absolutely. My pleasure,
more.
Paul.
Yeah.
This has been great.
You
really know your stuff, and I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Not as much as you,
well,
but I have a lot of questions. So.
Yeah, but this was fun. This was very cool, and I'm glad I could help out. Be glad to come back anytime.
Wonderful. Okay, thanks again.
And hey, thank you for checking out that podcast. I hope you'll join us again next week and the week after that. Check out some of our past episodes of the Digital Music News podcast. Also, what? You're not reading digitalmusicnews.com every day? Get out of here. Well, stay, but also read digitalmusicnews.com. Also, if you want to be on the serious up and up, subscribe to the Digital Music News Daily Snapshot, where we recap everything happening 7 a.m. in your mailbox, 4 a.m., depending on what time zone you're in. Then, of course, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook. We're everywhere. We're making the music industry smarter every single day. Digital Music News. I'm your host, Paul Reznikoff. Catch you next time.